My name is Stanley Laham, and I'm a PhD in immunology and medical microbiology. My doctoral dissertation was the discovery of a new virus of the retroviridae family. And that is my specialty.
As an immunologist, when you're studying that, Stanley, can you just give us a brief overview of the main components of the human immune system?
Okay, basically, the immune system was first discovered by a man called Metchnikov, who discovered in a transparent larvae that when he would stick a needle, there would be cells that would migrate towards that needle under his microscope and try to envelope the needle. And he called them phagocytes, from the Greek for ingesting particles. Anyway, that's a historical note. Basically, the first thing you study when you study immunology is that there are two types of immune responses. Humoral, because from blood, remember, blood was called humor, which is antibodies circulating in the blood, and cellular immunity. So you have humoral immunity, which is antibody immunity. Cellular immunity are T cells, killer T cells, and phagocytes and monocytes that actually ingest or kill bacteria or cells infected with a virus that are recognized as foreign. These are the two basic types of immune responses. Of course, the humoral immune response, and as you get more involved, it's a lot more intricate than that. There's a lot of interaction between the humoral immunity and cellular immunity. And humoral immunity does not just involve antibodies to an antigen. It also, there's what they call the complement cascade. Antibodies can fix complements that can, as you get to C9, that can actually lyse cells or bacteria. And you also have mast cells to which antibody, usually IgE, can stick to and make them release, you know, cytokines and histamines, which would give you an inflammatory response. Immunology is a very complicated, still not completely understood science. So it would, but basically what I've told you is basic knowledge in immunology.
Okay, so one of the key things, of course, is these antibodies, wonderful things, if you can get them. Right at the very beginning of all of this COVID-19 alarm, there was a kind of story that went out there, Stanley, saying that, well, you can catch this twice. So the idea really was to explain to people this is a very, very novel disease, because you can catch it and then you can catch it again. Now, as we know, most things, your body is able to, if you manage to survive it, your body is much better prepared the next time. And it may even be that you hardly notice it the next time that one of these viruses, strays, you stray upon it. So there's two questions there, really. One is this true? Do you think it's, this virus has some kind of way of just kind of bypassing your immune system and just coming at you again? And the other thing is, these antibodies, how long do they last? So I hope you don't mind me asking you those two questions in one.
I'll try to answer your two questions as one. When you get an infection with a virus, whether it's a coronavirus or an adenovirus or a cytomegalovirus of the herpes family, you form antibodies to that virus. Your body recognizes different parts of the virus as foreign entities, and you form antibodies to these various entities. Now, you can catch it twice, but the second time you'll have what they call a secondary response. In rare cases, you may have an allergic reaction where, you see, there are many kinds of antibodies. There's your first response is what they call IgM. Then after the IgM comes the IgGs. Ig stands for immunoglobulin. That's what antibodies are. So your first response, usually for something that you're seeing for the first time as foreign, is immunoglobulin M. Then your body starts forming immunoglobulin G, which is your main defense. There are also secretory antibodies that you secrete, that mother's milk has, that we call immunoglobulin A, IgA. And there's also IgE. Immunoglobulin E is mostly responsible for allergic reaction, for binding to mast cell and causing massive release of cytokines and histamines, all of the agents of inflammation. So when you catch a virus, normally the normal course of its pathogenesis is as you form IgM to it, then you start forming IgG. At the same time, you stimulate T lymphocytes that become activated against that particular virus. These T lymphocytes become experts at not killing the virus. This is the job of the antibodies, to bind the viruses and bind complement and fix complement. The T cells actually kill infected cells, because these infected cells have viral antigen on their surfaces and are recognized as a foreign entity. And a killer T cell will kill an infected cell, thereby fighting the infection. Because viruses do not replicate on their own. Viruses do not have replicative mechanism. You cannot put a virus in a nutrient broth and think it's going to replicate. A virus must use a cell's replicative mechanism in order to multiply. So when the T cell kills the cell, it effectively kills the virus factory. Now, at times, yes, you can, after a while, get reinfected by the same virus or the same virus that has mutated in order to avoid some of the antibodies that you had formed to it. But remember, you form many antibodies when you're infected with a virus after a natural infection, because you recognize many different structures in the virus. In rare cases, so you get a secondary response. In rare cases, it can produce what they call an inflammatory response. One, I'm going to say common, but it's not that common. We're talking about 1 in 100,000, but more common than 1 in 1,000,000. There are reactions like what they call Guillain-Barré syndrome, where now your immune system, because of infection with the virus, starts attacking the myelin sheath of your nerves, and you get you get muscle weaknesses, even of motor nerves, even sometimes respiratory nerves, which has to be treated. Another common reaction is what we call Bell's palsy, where you get facial paralysis due to a viral infection. Again, these are rare occurrences. So you can get a relapse with a virus. You will do a secondary response and fight it off very fast. In rare cases, you may get syndromes of autoimmune complications such as Guillain-Barré or Bell's palsy or many others. But this is to be expected in biological systems. It's a very complicated machinery, a very complicated choreography to fight off, you know, a viral infection.
Yeah, but this secondary response, I mean, we're being led to believe that the secondary response, so this is the second time you catch it, you've got some sort of memory T cells producing antibodies, and that this could be, you know, actually quite serious, the secondary response. What's the normal case with SARS-CoV-2? You know, is there any really evidence that the secondary response can be dangerous, deadly as the first?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I just had a few examples of people who had it, who went to a concert. They had it last year. They went to a concert in January in the Dominican Republic and caught the other variant and fought it off extremely rapidly. The only reason they knew that's what they had is because their antibody titers shot up to 10 times what it was before. So they knew they were exposed to the virus again. Because after a while, your body will not keep making antibodies when the virus is not there. It's normal that the antibody titer goes down. That doesn't mean you're not protected. You have your memory T cells and you have... By the way, antibodies are made by B lymphocytes and your memory B cells to have a very rapid secondary response. And the second infection is not as, you know, the pathogenesis of a reinfection is very mild compared to the first infection.
Okay, so what is the evidence for duration? Sorry.
Tony, to start off, I have to tell you that with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, we're talking about 80% of the people who caught it did not need medical assistance. They fought it off on their own. Perhaps 20% needed medical attention. Of those, perhaps between 1% and 5% needed hospitalization. So when you say that the second infection, the reinfection with COVID-19 can be as devastating as the first, no, it won't be unless, like I explained to you, in some cases, you get an autoimmune response. But this is saying that as if all first cases of SARS-CoV-2 are extremely grave. They were not. And which brings me back to the question. You're saying that cases are increasing. We're reporting so many. Is this due to the new variants? Well, what are cases? When they say more cases are being reported, is it more sick people that are being reported, or is it more positive testing that's being reported?
Well, no, it's the people are definitely not sick. I've just spoken to somebody whose daughter works in Southmead Hospital, which is the biggest hospital in the city here, apart from maybe the Bristol Royal Infirmary. They're both enormous hospitals for the city, the two big ones, and she said they've got 5 patients in there with COVID.
And it's not really alarming when they say we're reporting more cases these days, this week, than last week. One would expect, first of all, it depends on how many people actually goes to get tested. And second of all, in any pandemic, you expect that the number of people exposed to the virus will increase exponentially. This is absolutely normal. And as a matter of fact, that's how herd immunity is achieved. So I don't see an alarming news when reporting that more and more people are testing positive for the virus. It was to be expected.
Okay, well, what about the longevity of the immune response? That is to say, you know, these antibodies and your memory B cells being able to produce them at a moment's notice. How long does that last for in the body, and can it be passed on at all?
How long does it last? It can last for years. A couple of years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Sometimes 10 years, depending on the virus and the antigen. Sometimes a lifetime. That's why some vaccines, you only need it once in a lifetime. What was the second part of your question? I'm sorry.
Okay, so I'm just asking really about the, can it also be passed on to the next generation at all?
No. What a mother passes on to her baby is what is called passive immunity. We haven't seen, and it hasn't been recorded enough, of a genetic passing on of immunity. Passive immunity in a baby is usually acquired through mother's milk and mother's blood. All the immunoglobulins, except for IgM, remember I told you IgM, immunoglobulin M, is the first that you usually produce. Now, that's a very big immunoglobulin. It's composed of, it's the size of 4 immunoglobulin Gs. It does not go through the placenta into the fetus's bloodstream, but all the IgE of the mother does. So everything she had immunity to, the baby has, but not inherited. Apparently, these will fade away. We call that passive immunity. A baby has passive immunity from the antibodies that were passed on through the placenta to the fetus. Also, there's IgA. Remember I told you there was a kind of immunoglobulin that we call secretory immunoglobulin? That's the IgA. It's passed on in mother's milk to the baby and protects the baby. But that is not genetic immunity. The baby has to, in the long run, after a while, develop its own immunity, its own memory cells, its own. That's why even though most people have been vaccinated with the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine, which is a very important thing, and even these vaccines, traditional vaccine, can once in a while cause an autoimmune response. But a baby, after a few months, after it needs its own immune system to be stimulated by these antigens for that baby to become immune. At birth, it has its mother's antibodies in its bloodstream, but these fade away.
The cytokine storm you mentioned, this is one of the curious features of SARS. And apparently some doctors, certainly the beginning stages of this, believed that actually it was a pneumonia that people had, when actually this was the cytokine storm going on. Can you tell us what is a cytokine storm? And is there any basic way in which you, through your diet or anything like that, can help your body to regulate it, to make sure that your body doesn't produce this cytokine storm? Because obviously, certainly from what I've read, Stanley, and correct me if I'm wrong, this has been one of the major problems that's been killing people, is that there's this inflammation caused by this cytokine storm, which has been kind of stopping people's ability to breathe oxygen, to actually get the oxygen into their bloodstream.
Yes. The cytokine storm causes mini thrombosis in a lot, in the capillaries where the alveoli of the lungs are. the alveoli of the lungs, their function is to take the oxygen you breathe in and give it to the hemoglobin of the blood circulating through them. Now, if you have some many blood clots blocking that, you're obviously not going to get the oxygen. The oxygen will not be transferred to the hemoglobin. Now, the cytokine storm in general, this is again, like I told you, caused by mast cells that release too much. They have their functions. They have their beneficial function. But when they're too much is released, you get this inflammatory response. You get all these blood clots caused in the capillaries because of the inflammation in them. And they are caused by what they call the cells that release these cytokines are called mast cells. And usually they are activated by immunoglobulin E, IgE, that you form to the virus. Now, is there a kind of diet that can, I don't know. I don't know if there's if a special diet can help you reduce the chance of producing IgE as opposed to IgG. It's possible, but I don't want to speculate on it because I don't know.
Okay, because I mean, all I'm saying is I've heard that vitamin D can play quite an important role there, and that those that have had a lot of vitamin D, say for example, who have been taking pills. Have found that the cytokine storm is less bad. But anyway,
coming to that, yes. Whether it's vitamin D, whether it's zinc, whether it's hydroxychloroquine, they all have what they call a modulating effect on the immune system. So they will help. This is why at the beginning, when hydroxychloroquine was recommended and that nobody seem to have paid any attention. The journal Nature Cellular Biology, had articles showing that not only that it does inhibit the SARS-CoV-2 replication in culture, that is in vitro, when you have tissue cultures, nasopharyngeal tissue cultures of nasopharyngeal cells, and you infect them with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, it was shown that the chloroquine inhibits its growth. Plus, chloroquine had that other benefit, which is why it's been used for the last two decades as an immune modulator in the autoimmune diseases called rheumatoid arthritis and systemic lupus erythematosus. It's part of the regimen to control, but there are no viruses involved in those diseases. These are autoimmune diseases where your immune system is attacking itself, different parts, depending on which autoimmune disease you have. And chloroquine was found to moderate the immune system to make it less deadly against itself, to make it have less of a reaction against self-antigens. That's why we call it an immune modulator.
Okay, Stanley, you've looked at lots of different types of viruses and the way they spread and also develop over time. We've been told a lot about how many cases are being detected of this Delta variant. Of course, that does depend partly on how many tests you do. And if you're ramping up testing, you're bound to find more because many of these people are not actually sick and they wouldn't even know to get tested unless you had gone to them and said, please, will you get a test? But what about the way that SARS-CoV-2 has developed over time? Is it right to say that viruses like this generally tend to get more transmissive and less deadly over time?
Yes, it's to the virus's advantage to first of all, be more transmissive, and second of all, to not be lethal to its host. Because if a virus is lethal to its host, it's a dead end for the virus, especially if it's so lethal that it kills the host before it has the host has time to spread it to many people. A successful virus is one that is not lethal, as a matter of fact, that perhaps you can barely notice, and where the host can spread it to a myriad of people around him or her. That is a successful virus. If it kills the host, it's a dead end for the virus. So yes, it is to the advantage, it's to the evolutionary advantage of a virus to become less pathogenic and more transmissive.
So, I mean, have you noticed this going on with this Delta variant at all? And have you ever seen it happening with other viruses in the past?
Yeah. Actually, it happens every day with your rhinoviruses or adenoviruses that cause the common cold. I mean, it's not something extraordinary out of science fiction. Viruses mutate, and with the flu virus, that's why you may catch the flu 1 year, and next year you have a variant that you catch again. So that's nothing new. It's not something particular just to the coronaviruses. Now, one thing that's being propagated is that everybody who has been infected with the coronavirus that had COVID-19 should also get vaccinated, because that will give them a stronger immunity. That is a fallacy. When you get vaccinated, when you get infected with the coronavirus, as I explained to you before, your body sees the whole virus and makes antibodies to various parts, various structures of the virus. The vaccines that have been developed, this mRNA technology that has been developed, only gives you a monoclonal antibody, because they're taking a piece of mRNA that codes for a specific antigen in the spike protein antigen. They're injecting it into you. You're not seeing a whole virus. This mRNA is not a virus. What it does is that your cells are supposed to capture it and translate it into that protein. That's what they call going from mRNA, messenger RNA, to protein. The process is called translation. And that protein that is made intracellularly after your cells absorb that mRNA goes to the cell membrane, where it becomes visible to your immune system, and you make antibodies and activate cellular immunity against that specific structure. The antibodies you make are called monoclonal antibodies. They are specific for that product, the protein product, which is one protein, the protein product of that mRNA. Now, the person who got infected with the virus, on the other hand, does that same antibody plus others to other parts of the virus, to many other parts of the virus. So that person is much better prepared to fight off any new variant than the person who was vaccinated. Because the person who was vaccinated, if the mutation that caused that new variant is that exact protein that this mRNA vaccine coded for, then he will have much less protection than the person who is actually naturally vaccinated with the virus and has about 7 to 8 different type of antibodies to 7 to 8 different structures of the virus. I want to point out another advantage. The person who was infected, who had actually had COVID-19, did something else. He produced interferon. That interferon is something that your cells produce that goes and tells other cells that there's a virus around, and they make a protein that protects them against absorption with that virus. So the person who had COVID-19 actually produced interferon for that COVID-19. The person who was vaccinated with mRNA does not. So that's another layer of protection that the person with who was naturally infected has over the person who was vaccinated. So to tell people who had COVID-19, oh yes, go get that mRNA vaccine, is to me an absurdity.
What's the effect then if you have this kind of double immunity? That's what most people believe, that you've got some sort of natural immunity, but you've also got that boosted by having the vaccine too.
that is baloney. What it's going to do, yes, it's going to make you, it's going to boost only one thing, that specific monoclonal antibody, only the B cells that are specifically targeted that single protein. But at the same time, you risk an autoimmune response to a much greater degree than the person who had not had COVID-19. And I just had a case of somebody who had COVID-19, who was hospitalized. They thought he was having a heart attack. What he was getting is pericarditis due to an inflammatory response from the vaccine, and having water, leakage of fluid into his pericardium. And if you want to hear the whole story, that person had already had a heart attack, and his insurance did not cover, he had insurance for everything, excluding heart attacks, heart events. So I had advised them to not report this as a heart event, but as an inflammatory response to the vaccine, which the insurance company accepted as an explanation and paid the hospital. He was 5 days in hospital and fluid was taken out of his pericardium.
Amazing. Well, it's a very different system there to here, Stanley. What do you make of this this whole idea of having both, though? Is it likely that there's any adverse effects from having both? Surely, the idea is that there can't be any harm in having had COVID to have your memory, B cells, your antibodies and a vaccine.
But this is precisely what I'm telling you, Tony. You increase the chances of an inflammatory response to the vaccine if you had COVID over the person who did not have COVID. And it does not afford you, it will afford you temporarily a higher titer of antibodies to the spike protein, which will fade away. Your protection, your real protection once you've had COVID, are your memory cells to many different parts of the virus.
So how does that work? I mean, why does the inflammation take place? What can you just explain the mechanism?
The mechanism is precisely what we've been talking about. The chances is that you might stimulate mast cells in your immune response that causes an inflammatory response. This is this is an inflammatory response is one of the natural responses to having a thorn in your skin. Sometimes it's called a walling off effect. You don't want to have that kind of inflammatory response systemically from a vaccine. It's as simple as that.
Is there any actual difference then between these two types of vaccine, the AstraZeneca and the Pfizer and Moderna, the mRNA and the adenovirus seem to be, I mean, they're talked about together. It's not encouraged for people to, you know, really say, I want one particular virus or another one. In fact, I was talking to somebody who's one of the officials at the Journalists Union here in the UK, who was saying to me that that he'd heard that Pfizer were on a big campaign to get news stories out about AstraZeneca being dangerous. And, you know, these sorts of questions, a lot of journalists just simply don't know the questions to answer to interrogate statements that are put forward by Pfizer. And, you know, anyway, so there seems to be a sort of a commercial side to the news. So we're getting stories which will make us think, oh, well, one vaccine is better than another vaccine. But actually what's pushing that is not the balanced science. It's a kind of marketing campaign almost from one vaccine firm.
Tony, I'm surprised that you can see that and that you don't see that in the marketing of the millions of people who have had COVID asymptomatically or mildly to go get a vaccine. It's the same commercial interest. Now, you talk about Pfizer doing it to AstraZeneca. Pfizer is also doing it to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine here. They're saying there's an increased risk of Guillain-Barré with the Johnson & Johnson as opposed with the Pfizer. Pfizer is a much bigger company. They're winning the commercial war. It's to their advantage. Remember when we spoke last time and that the vaccine had only been, it had only been 3 months of vaccination. Pfizer had already reported $900 million in profit. So yes, they do try to discredit the competitor. They do it all the time. But I have to tell you, you're asking me what's the difference. You see, you mix questions, Tony. The difference between the two is that with the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson, you're not given a piece of raw mRNA. That mRNA has been reverse transcripted into the DNA of an adenovirus. And you're given that adenovirus, and that's where it is transcribed and then translated into the protein. So you don't have circulating mRNA in your system. It's inside an adenovirus. But the end result is still, as far as the COVID-19 is concerned, you're just making one type of antibody. Because it's that same mRNA that Pfizer gives, just shoots into you, that they put into that adenovirus. And for some reason, AstraZeneca uses a simian, a monkey adenovirus. I have no idea why. That you would have to ask them. Whereas Johnson & Johnson uses the human adenovirus type 5. But the people who seem to have perfected that technique to have the least side effects seem to be the Sputnik V virus, which they use two different human adenoviruses to transfer immunity to the COVID-19. But the important difference between those viruses and Moderna and Pfizer is that they're not injecting directly into you a piece of mRNA that may be picked up. Supposedly, it's supposed to be only picked up by the muscle cells locally where it's injected. But they have no proof that it doesn't get picked up by, because once it's in your circulation, it may get picked up by hepatic cells, meaning liver cells, or lung cells, or heart cells. And these cells start producing the antigen and becoming looking foreign to your immune system. And the danger is that you might react to those cells and have an autoimmune disease.
Yeah, I've been seeing reports over the last few weeks saying that that is actually a myth, that it stays in your muscle tissue, that it's not. It's been detected all around the body, in the bloodstream, etc. Is that something to be worried about?
That is the thing to be worried about. It's not something to be worried about, Tony. This is the thing that I worried about since last February 2020, that I wrote about. I said the dangers with an mRNA is that it may get picked up by other cells, not just locally, and these cells will make antigens and be recognized as foreign. If enough of them pick up, if enough liver cells pick up that mRNA and start producing viral antigen, you're going to attack it. Your immune system is going to attack it. And this is a classic, you know, autoimmune hepatitis. Or if your heart cells, you know, this is not something new. People with rheumatic heart fever is because the antigen of a certain strep strain looks so much like an antigen in heart muscles that the antibodies you make to the strep cross-react with the heart muscles and attacks your own heart muscles. That's rheumatic heart fever. So it's not something new that comes around with corona all of a sudden. And this is the funny thing. Here comes the coronavirus and everybody becomes, you know, the first time they're hearing about the immune system and they think it's something absolutely novel. You know, this is not new. Autoimmune reactions are not new to a virus. I've even given you a case where it happens with a bacteria, with a strep, and causes rheumatic heart fever. So there's nothing new. So the only thing that's new with the coronavirus is the amount of commercialization and how they've taken advantage of that situation, big pharma, to make, astronomical, indecent amounts of money.
Stanley, we spoke to you about Haiti before. We've seen now that there was apparently no vaccination program in Haiti, and we've just seen that the president has been assassinated in his bed in this most extraordinary fashion by a team of mercenaries from the United States and from Colombia, apparently, but who were based at the Taiwanese embassy. I wonder what you make of that. I mean, actually, I know you deal quite a lot with people in the Dominican Republic. It is an extraordinary case, Haiti, in that there was no virtually very few deaths. They had an incredible response, but very positive to COVID. It seems like one of the best places in the world. Very few deaths due to COVID. And now the president's dead. I wonder what you make of all that's been going on down there.
Well, these are two separate subjects. All I can tell you about the president being dead and, it seems to be, a very murky story. People are being scapegoated. One thing that I can tell you for sure is that whoever prepared this, whoever were the masterminds behind that, would not dare antagonize the United States. Because you see, Haitians live in fear of not getting their visa to come to the US. This is just an hour and 45 minute trip to the US from Port-au-Prince. And I can tell you, whether oligarchs or middle class in Haiti, everybody needs their visa. And the U.S. could easily, if, and the U.S. is feigning indignation at this assassination. Well, and they're sending the FBI, I'm sure you've heard the story, that an FBI delegation has gone to Haiti to help investigate the crime. Don't you find that this is kind of bizarre when the most important eyewitness, actual eyewitness to the murder, is sequestered right here in Miami? This is where the FBI investigation should start. The wife actually saw who killed her husband. Why isn't she being questioned? Why is it that they're going to Haiti to question mercenaries who may or may not even know who hired them?
Well, that's a great question. I hadn't even thought of that one. We did have a chat about what the consequences or the reason why Haiti had such a good response to COVID-19. My own conclusion, Stanley, is that, you know, there was a lot of malaria there, so there was a lot of chloroquine circulated and people were on it, almost eating it like candy, you know, so, or sweets, as we say here in Britain. And so that may have given them some sort of measure of protection. What's your own best guess?
There are many factors that may be involved. One is the taking of chloroquine, either for malaria or preventively for malaria. The other thing is that there may be antibodies for the chikungunya epidemic that was in Haiti before that cross-reacts with the coronavirus. And there's a general theory that the Haitian people's immune system is much better prepared for a response against this virus because of the conditions in which they live. They have a hyperactive immune system. Like I said, there's a possibility that dengue fever and chikungunya and other arboviruses that are prevalent, you know, in the country, that are endemic in the country, may have given the population, you know, natural fighting capabilities against the coronavirus. There's also something else, is that people in Haiti take a tea. It's a tea from a plant called armoise. And they swear by it, that's what it keeps them from getting, what was keeping them from getting the coronavirus. But that's accompanied by a very strange phenomenon. After the story came out, and even, you know, the international press picked up on it, here the poorest country with no vaccine, all of a sudden, and that the president had said that we don't need vaccination in Haiti, all of a sudden we're hearing that cases are increasing in Haiti, that more people are getting sick from coronavirus than last year, which is kind of strange. If they were, if they had natural immunity to the virus, which had nothing to do with the virus itself, there's no reason why the variant would be more pathogenic than the original virus. So this story is kind of, I can't completely comprehend it. But as far as the assassination is concerned, like I've told you, whether it's the people that they're accusing or scapegoating or anything, or FBI investigation in Haiti, that's all, I think, showtime for sure.
It's incredible, really. I mean, that these people were arrested in the Taiwanese embassy. There's only a handful of Taiwanese embassies around the world, because most countries don't recognize Taiwan. They would prefer to have a good relationship with China, you know, and say, well, we think Taiwan is part of China, and so they don't have a Taiwanese embassy, but they did in Haiti. Anyway, look.
Something strike you as kind of funny. How could they go inside the Taiwanese embassy to arrest these people? That is the sovereign territory of Taiwan, unless Taiwan handed them over.
Well, yes. I mean, I think if it's something as serious as the assassination of the president of the country, maybe those usual diplomatic channels are used to say, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to allow these people to have some kind of immunity from prosecution in there.
Unless they were expelled from the Taiwanese embassy. But the whole story stinks to high heaven. And like I said, there is no way that the United States was not aware of what was going to happen. Because the people who planned it would have feared retribution. Retribution that goes not necessarily going to jail, but the freezing of their bank accounts, which most of them have here in the United States, or taking away their visa from coming to the United States. They would not risk it unless they knew that, as far as the United States is concerned, they could get away from it, except those that will be scapegoated, you know.
Anyway, Stanley, just on the big picture, stepping back for a minute, have you had COVID-19 yourself? Have you had the vaccines?
No, I haven't had COVID-19 myself. As far as the vaccine is concerned, my granddaughter my daughter comes here, and for her peace of mind, I took the Johnson & Johnson vaccine about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I can't remember. I never followed up to go do an antibody neutralizing test to see if I really have neutralizing antibodies to it. But I did take the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Why did you decide to do that then? Was this really just for peace of mind?
For my daughter's peace of mind. For everybody around. Like, you know, I've had many friends ask me, should I take that? I said, well, you know, socially it may become necessary for you, but scientifically, there's really no proof, no reason to go take it until the third stage studies are completed, which will be next year.
So why did you choose that one?
Because it's an adenovirus and I didn't want a piece of mRNA circulating, in my bloodstream.
And for somebody who has had COVID, any listeners who've had it, what would you say to, how do they know? Because, for example, I believe I had it in December 2019 before it was even supposed to exist. If I'm thinking about having or not having a vaccine, as you're saying, it's not a good idea to be having a vaccine if you've already had COVID. How do you know?
Did you ever get tested for antibodies for it?
Never.
Okay. Well, it wouldn't be a bad idea because I would advise you to go and ask for a quantitative neutralizing antibody test. Okay? And this will tell you whether you're positive or not. If you're positive, that doesn't mean you had COVID back in December when you thought you had it, but sometime during the year, you were exposed to it. I did that antibody test last summer, and I had no antibodies to the COVID-19. So I'm almost positive I was never exposed to it. But this is what anybody should do if they want to know if they were exposed to it, if they had it asymptomatically without even, is to do a neutralizing antibody test. An antibody test.
I mean, would that neutralizing antibody test pick up antibodies from an infection 18 months ago?
No, if the titer is too low, it will not, after 18 months, it will not pick it up. But if you've been in contact with people, you'd be surprised. You might, if the virus was so prevalent around and you've been in contact with a lot of people, you may have been re-stimulated since then and still have antibodies. But not having them doesn't mean that you, it's not that you don't have them. You don't have detectable titers. Doesn't mean that you didn't get it 18 months ago. But you can do it just to satisfy your curiosity.
Well, it may actually just make me more curious by having that test, especially if it comes back negative, because I'm almost certain from the symptoms that I had it. Anyway, finally, Stanley, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of Pfizer and Moderna here and say to you, look, the reason that they use that type of mRNA, that the spike protein is the important part of this virus, that actually they are targeting the most deadly part of the virus, this spike protein, with their mRNA vaccines. And that is actually far more important than, as you were saying, the immune system, which will sort of look at the side of it, the back of it, whatever this virus, other parts of the virus, other aspects of it. But they are targeting the most deadly part of the virus. And that's why their vaccine is better than your your immune system in your body.
That's absurd, because first of all, your immune system, if you had the natural infection, you did make antibodies to the spike protein. And second of all, they're even talking about the spike protein being the toxic part, that it might even be toxic. My answer to those people at Pfizer, that's why I would love, I've asked you if you could get a scientist that would come and try and debunk what I'm saying. I would love it to have a discussion with one, because if the spike protein is that dangerous, what they are selling is the spike protein. The mRNA is coding for the spike protein and putting it in circulation in your body so that your body can pick, can make antibodies to it. And at the same time, what I would like to tell them is that what guarantee that you have that it stays only locally in your arm muscles, and that mRNA is not picked up. Show me the research, which they haven't shown to anybody. There was a piece of research that came out that showed that quite a bit accumulated in the liver, lungs, spleen, but it's unofficial. I cannot verify the authenticity of that. But show me that your mRNA cannot get picked up, does not circulate and get picked up by other organs, and not just produce spike protein locally in your arm muscle. That it may not be picked up by cells of your liver that is going to make spike proteins. That's what I would ask them.
Now, isn't it interesting, because it sounds from what you're saying as if Pfizer and Moderna could have actually, targeted a different part of SARS-CoV-2, which wouldn't be so deadly, but necessarily your body would recognize it as something foreign. It would attack it, but it wouldn't be actually floating around in your body something so dangerous as the spike protein. And maybe that would have been a better approach.
No, actually, if you're going to make just one antibody, that's to their defense. If you're going to make just one monoclonal antibody, it's better that it's to the spike protein, which is the attachment site of the virus. It's in the attachment site to the cell receptors. So if you're just going to make one type of antibody, then it's better that it will be more effective if it's to the spike protein to stop the spread of the virus internally. So that argument is what they chose to, you know, to manufacture, to isolate the mRNA, the protein that, for which they isolated the mRNA. If you're going to have only one type of antibody, then it would be the spike protein.
Okay, well, look, how about a different approach with ivermectin? Am I right in thinking that this also attacks the, or it doesn't attack it, but it stops the spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 actually getting into your cell in the first place to start replicating?
Well, Tony, this is precisely what we've been saying for the last year and a half. If you're going to fight a virus that can, according to your own data, easily mutate to give new variants that for which you will need to make new vaccines, why not work on antivirals instead of vaccines that will inhibit replication of any variant? And this is exactly what ivermectin is. Ivermectin doesn't care if the spike protein changes in structure. Ivermectin inhibits both intracellularly, the migration at the ribosomal stage, the replication of the virus. So it would be much better to invest in looking for other antivirals than to, which would be there for any variant, than to think, well, you know, what, every year there might be a new variant, we'll have to make a new vaccine. Of course, there are billions and billions of dollars to make. You will make some money to begin with the patent, but once the patent expires, you know, you would have a cheap way to combat the virus. Have you ever wondered why herpes virus, you know, we have such a good antiviral, which is acyclovir, and we don't really go around, except for lately, making vaccine to the different types of herpes viruses. We have good antiviral. Acyclovir is a good antiviral. And we use it commonly for herpes infections. There isn't really the necessity of having a herpes simplex 1 vaccine, a herpes simplex 2, which is venereal herpes, a virus, because we have antivirals. And I'm always, you know, it's this has been my main point of contention, that we already saw that two molecules, whether hydroxychloroquine and even more effective ivermectin, work in inhibiting, you know, the replication of the virus, no matter what variant. Why not work on developing more antivirals?
Well, that's another very, very good question. How does ivermectin actually operate, though? What is it doing in there to stop the virus replicating?
It stops the virus both extracellularly from attaching and intracellularly. Once inside, the mRNA of the virus, which is an RNA, it's a long piece of mRNA. It has to go to the ribosomes, where it's translated into new virus. It inhibits it at the ribosomal stage.
Well, on the Saturday, the 24th of July, 2021, it's been called International Ivermectin Day. A day for the recognition of ivermectin, the key to end the pandemic. COVID is treatable with ivermectin. Apparently, this is a campaign group of doctors here in the UK called BIRD are saying this, Stanley. Why is it that the big question is, why is it that there's been such resistance to people even talking about ivermectin as a treatment? Because we've seen, you know, discussions I've had with you immediately removed from YouTube, etc. And I'm not the only one. Many people have had to migrate to other channels because they've been so much as mentioning ivermectin as a possible treatment for COVID. They get basically hammered out of existence. That you're gone. Your channel's disappeared, etc.
You know, that's a very good question. It's a question that, you know, I can't answer. Obviously, it all has to do with money, the money that the big pharma thinks it can make from this disaster. There was a book written called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, how every, from a pandemic to an earthquake, can be used to make a lot of money for those, for the oligarchs who are already there. And I think that's the story of COVID-19. We had a president, Mr. Trump, whom I considered has the intellect of a seventh grader, but who spoke a truth. And because of political reason, they shut him up. If they can prevent a president of the United States of America from talking, you can imagine they can stop a doctor. Now, the problem is nobody had the gut. If all the doctors put together and say, yes, ivermectin, then people would have to listen, even big pharma. But unfortunately, at least in the United States, and I'm sure the same in England, the American Medical Association is almost a wholly owned subsidiary of Big Pharma. So that answers your question, why nobody publishes. Big corporations look after big corporations.
Yeah, it's also interesting if you trace back the stock, who owns the stock in these. It's also, that's another aspect that people often forget. You know, sometimes some massive TV companies, the same stockholders as, say, a vaccine manufacturer. But anyway, looking at this market, 7 billion people Bill Gates wants to have a vaccine. That's, with a double shot, that's 14 billion, with around about £20, sometimes more, sometimes less, per shot in English money. You're looking at potentially here a 300 billion annual turnover industry. That's just for the double shot COVID vaccine around the world, Stanley.
Yeah, that's the as a matter of fact, the pharmaceutical industry, I think, is catching up and surpassing the oil industry. I think the only perhaps competitor as far as making money is the military and industrial complex that can compete with the pharmaceutical industry, with big pharma. We're talking about literally, you know, trillions, not billions, trillions of dollars. Well, I'm sure you're aware that Pfizer just had to pay $2.1 billion in a lawsuit settlement, and it doesn't even seem to bother them. The pharmaceutical industry pays an average of five, and any of your listeners can check that, $5 to $6 billion a year in lawsuit settlements. If an industry can bleed $6 billion a year and still be one of the most profitable industry this planet has ever known, you can imagine how much money they're making. Normally, when a company settles for a settlement of $2.1 billion, it would sink. I think even, you know, this is something that would affect a company like Ford or General Motors a lot more than the pharmaceutical companies. It seems to be, you know, like a mosquito bite on an elephant.
Okay, Stanley, finally, I'm going to say finally again, can you just give us some tips as of places to follow where you think that you can actually get a little bit better info? I mean, I've just mentioned the Bird Group. That's their website is bird, B-I-R-D hyphen group.org. But are there any other places that you think that are good for people that are fed up with what's the mainstream media, which seems to be being turned into this sort of vaccine advertising news, you know, the news service, which isn't really being very balanced anymore, just putting out this stuff about vaccines the whole time, scaring people. Oh, gosh, you know, it's another terrible wave of cases. And then they don't mention that there's hardly anybody actually sick. So where are good places to go? If you could just give us one or two online to follow what's really going on.
Unfortunately, I would love to. I can't. I can tell you myself, most of my interaction with other scientists is on ResearchGate.org. And it's where you can ask questions and ask relevant questions and have many scientists give their opinions. And it's a little bit, it's a lot more less policed than, say, YouTube or any of the other, or Facebook or anything like that. You know, it's the I have not seen any censoring there. There's, so it's a good place to follow what scientists have to say about it.
Okay, so, I mean, don't hold your breath, but I will see if we can get one of these Pfizer or Moderna scientists, one of these people who's pro-mRNA, to debate with you next time, Stanley. But in the meantime, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tony.